but tonight, no one was sitting at the table. The servants had laid it out with a cornucopian buffet of food. In addition to the selection of roast beef, brook trout, chicken à l'orange, endless trays of vegetables, and rosemary potatoes au gratin, there were all sorts of chocolate desserts and fruit tarts. The pumpkin pie, like all pumpkin pie, looked like something a dog would eat. But the whipped chantilly cream on top of it looked delicious. She watched in silence as weary, saddened people streamed into the room, exchanged a few words with Mrs. Vanderbilt, and then joined the gathering. In what appeared to be a valiant effort to stay upbeat, Mr. and Mrs. Brahms came in and tried to eat some food and find some solace in the company of the others. Mr. Vanderbilt went over and spoke to them, and they seemed to find great comfort in his words and touch. He then went over to the pastor and his wife and consoled them about their lost son. He went next to Nolan's distraught mother and father. Nolan's father was the blacksmith, but he and his wife were welcome here. Mr. Vanderbilt spoke with them for a long time. The more she watched him, the more her feelings toward him softened. There seemed to be true and genuine caring in him, not just for his guests, but for the people who worked for him as well. Braden, following his uncle's example and looking particularly neat in his black jacket and vest, did his best to talk with a young red-haired girl in a blue dress. The young lady appeared to be more than a little frightened by everything that had been going on. There were other children there as well, looking scared and sullen. Mr. Bozeman, the estate superintendent, was in attendance, along with Mr. Pratt and Miss Whitney, and many other familiar faces. It seemed to her that the only person missing was poor old Mr. Rostanoff. Serafina overheard one of the manservants come in and say that Mr. Rostanoff had sent word that he was too heartsick to attend. She glanced over at Mr. Thorne and Mr. Bendel, who were standing together near the fire. Mr. Thorne looked haggard and tired. When he started to cough a little, he covered his mouth and turned away from Mr. Bendel. It appeared Mr. Thorne might be feeling ill or coming down with a cold. Such a difference from the other times she'd seen him. Nobody was feeling good tonight. When she saw that nearly everyone was present, Mrs. Vanderbilt turned to Mr. Thorne and put her hand on his shoulder. "Perhaps you would be kind enough to play something for us." Mr. Thorne looked reluctant.
"Indeed," Mr. Bendel said encouragingly. "We could all use a bit of cheering up."
"Of course, I would be honored to oblige,"
Mr. Thorne said quietly, wiping his mouth with his handkerchief and gathering himself. It took several seconds, but he seemed to find a second wind. He glanced around the room as if looking for inspiration. "Shall I send the footman for your violin?" Mrs. Vanderbilt asked, trying to be helpful.
"No, no, thank you. I was thinking I would give that magnificent pipe organ a try,"
Mr. Thorne said. Serafina panicked. She had heard the pipe organ many times before from the basement. She couldn't even imagine how loud it would be when she was crouching among its pipes. It would break her eardrums for sure. She hurried to wiggle herself out of her hiding spot and escape. At the same time, Braden rushed forward and grabbed Mr. Thorne's arm.
"Perhaps you could play the piano instead, Mr. Thorne? I do love the piano."
Surprised, Mr. Thorne paused and looked at his young friend.
"Is that what you would prefer, Master Braden?"
"Oh, yes, sir. I'd love to hear you play."
"Very well,"
Mr. Thorne said. Much relieved, Serafina smiled at her ally's quick thinking and crawled back into her hiding spot. Braden risked a quick glance up toward her, his face momentarily betraying a self-satisfied grin. She couldn't help but smile in return. Mr. Thorne walked over to the grand piano.
"I thought you played the violin," Mr. Bendel said.
"Lately I've been tinkering a bit with the piano as well," Mr. Thorne said quietly.
He sat down in front of the piano slowly, almost shyly, as if he was uncertain. He sat there for several long seconds while everyone waited. And then, without taking off his satin gloves, he began to play. He played a soft and enchanting sonata with the grace of a virtuoso. The piece he had selected was not too sad and not too happy, but it was lovely in its own way, and it seemed to bring everyone together in mood and spirit. Serafina marveled at how music seemed to have an almost magical ability to unite the emotions of the people in a room. Everyone seemed to truly love and appreciate Mr. Thorne's playing, except Mr. and Mrs. Brahms, who seemed to grow sadder with every note he played. Mrs. Brahms began to sob and pulled out her handkerchief, and then her apologetic husband had to take her away. The other guests continued to listen to Mr. Thorne's music as he finished the sonata.
"Thank you, Mr. Thorne," Mrs. Vanderbilt said, trying to stay positive. She looked around at everyone. "Why don't we all see if we can have a little bite to eat and something to drink?"
Braden approached Mr. Thorne shyly.
"You play wonderfully, sir."
"Thank you, Braden," Mr. Thorne said with a small smile. "I appreciate it. I know you are a young man of discerning taste."
"A few weeks ago, when you first arrived at Biltmore, you told us a delightful story about the boy with three wishes."
"Yes," Mr. Thorne looked at him.
"Do you have any others?"
Braden asked, looking around at the red-haired girl in the blue dress and the other children.
"Could you tell us another story?"
Mr. Thorne paused and looked at Mrs. Vanderbilt, who nodded in agreement, looking proud of her nephew for his consideration of the others.
"I think that would be wonderful if you could, Mr. Thorne. We'd all enjoy it."
"Then I shall endeavor to try," Mr. Thorne agreed, nodding.
He slowly waved his arm to the children.
"Let's all gather around the hearth."
As Braden and the other children sat in the glowing light of the fire, Mr. Thorne lowered his voice into a dramatic tone and began to tell a story. Watching and listening from the organ loft, Serafina could see that the children were leaning forward, following the story intently. Mr. Thorne's voice was soft at times, and then booming with force at other times. She found herself longing to gather around and listen with the other children. Her heart ached to be a part of the world he depicted, a place where all the boys and girls had mamas and papas and brothers and sisters. A place where the children played together in bright fields, and when they got tired, lay about in the shade of a giant tree on top of a hill. Serafina wanted to be in that world. She wanted to live that life. The story made her long to see her mama and hear her voice. And when the story was done, she thought Mr. Thorne must be one of the most magnificent storytellers she had ever heard. Mrs. Vanderbilt watched Braden sitting among the other children and looking up at Mr. Thorne. There was a contented look on her face. Braden was finally making friends. Serafina studied Mr. Thorne. There was no denying that he had warmed her heart. She'd loved his music and his story, and he had brought a sense of community and togetherness to the sad gathering for a little while. Braden and Mr. Bendel were right. He was a man of many talents. Afterward, as the gathering was breaking up,
Mrs. Vanderbilt approached Mr. Thorne and gently embraced him.
"Thank you, sir, for all you've been doing for us. I especially appreciate the way you've befriended Braden. He thinks the world of you."
"I just wish I could do more," Mr. Thorne said. "These are such difficult times for everyone." "You're a good man, Montgomery," said Mr. Vanderbilt as he walked up and shook Mr. Thorne's hand in gratitude. "Later this evening, I would like to invite you and Mr. Bendel to join me in the billiard room for cognac and cigars. Just us friends."
"Thank you very much, George,"
Mr. Thorne said, bowing slightly.
"I'm honored. I look forward to it."
As Seraphina watched the interaction, something didn't sit quite right with her. Mr. Thorne looked somber, as he should at a sorrowful gathering such as this. But she noticed something else, too. As Mr. Vanderbilt spoke with him, Mr. Thorne had the same look on his face that a possum gets when he's gnawing on a sweet tater he's grubbed out of the garden. He seemed pleased with himself, too pleased, and not just for his flawless playing and his wonderful story. He seemed delighted by the personal invitation to join George Vanderbilt's inner circle. Braden had told her that his uncle and Mr. Thorne had only known each other for a few months, but now she could see there was a stronger connection developing between them, a growing personal bond. The Vanderbilts were one of the most famous, wealthy, and powerful families in all of America. And Mr. Thorne had just made himself a most valued friend. She looked over at Braden to see if he, too, sensed something was amiss. But he wasn't even looking at Mr. Thorne. As everyone was leaving the room, he was walking along the buffet table, discreetly stuffing pieces of breaded chicken into his pocket. Then he snatched a little jar of clotted cream from the scone tray. She couldn't help but feel her mouth watering at the sight of the glorious food. She'd forgotten how hungry she was, and Braden seemed to know exactly what she liked. As he followed his aunt and uncle out of the room, Braden looked up at her. She signaled for him to meet her outside. There was much to talk about. She knew Mr. Thorne was well-liked, but to her, he was too talented, too kind, too something. And she still couldn't figure out why he had called Mr. Rostanov Papa. She couldn't put it all together, but she smelled a rat. Chapter 17. Seraphina met Braden outside in the darkness at the base of the great house's rear foundation, where they hoped no one would see them. The forested valley of the French Broad River lay below them, and the black silhouette of the mountains layered into the distance. A mist was rising up from the canopy of the valley trees as if the entire forest was breathing. "Did you see how well Mr. Thorne played the piano?" Seraphina asked in disbelief. "Did you know he could do that?"
"No, but he can do a lot of things," Braden said, pulling the bits of chicken out of his pocket and handing them over to her.
"You're right, he can," she said as she gobbled the chicken down. "We keep saying that, but how is it possible?"
"That's just the way he is," Braden said as Seraphina slurped up the clotted cream.
"But what do you know about Mr. Thorne?" she asked as she wiped her mouth. "I mean, what do you really know about him?"
"My uncle says that he should be an inspiration to us all."
"Yes, but how do you know you can trust him?"
"I told you, he saved Gideon, and he's been very helpful to my aunt and uncle. I don't understand why you dislike him so much."
"We've got to follow the clues," she said.
"He's a good man," Braden said, becoming increasingly upset.
You can't just go around accusing everyone. He's been nothing but nice to me.
She nodded in understanding. Brayden was a loyal person. But stop for a second. Who is he, Brayden?
He's a friend of Mr. Bendel and my uncle.
Yes, but where does he come from?
Mr. Bendel told me that way back before the war between the states, Mr. Thorne owned a large estate in South Carolina. It was burned and destroyed by the Union troops. He'd been born and raised a rich man, a landowner, but he lost every penny and had to flee for his life.
He doesn't seem poor now, she said, confused by the story.
Mr. Bendel said that after the war, Mr. Thorne was so poor he could barely survive. He had no house, no property, no money, and no food. He became a homeless drunk, wandering through the streets, swearing obscenities at any northerner who happened to walk by.
Serafina frowned. This is Montgomery Thorne you're talking about. The man who can do everything? Your description doesn't match with the Mr. Thorne I've seen.
I know, Brayden said in exasperation. That's what I'm saying. He's had a hard life, a bad life, but he turned himself around. He's been nothing but kind to me. You have no cause to think ill of him.
Just finish the story you were telling me. What else? What happened to him? How'd he get here?
Mr. Bendel told me that one night, after drinking too much in a pub in one of the local villages, Mr. Thorne was walking home, stumbled off the road, and got lost in the woods. He fell into an old well that no one used anymore and was badly hurt. I guess he was stuck down there for 2 days. He can't even remember who found him and helped him out of the well. But when he finally recovered from his injuries, he realized that he'd hit rock bottom in his life and would soon die if he didn't change his ways. So he decided to make a better man of himself.
What does that mean? She asked,
thinking the whole story sounded like two buckets of hogwash and that Mr. Bendel had been pulling Brayden's leg. Mr. Thorne got a job working in a factory in the city. He learned about the machines and got promoted to manager.
The machines? Serafina asked in surprise. What kind of machines?
I don't know. Factory machines. But after that, he became an attorney.
What's that? She asked.
She couldn't believe all the stuff she didn't know. A lawyer, sort of an expert on laws and crime.
How did he become an attorney when he was working in a factory?
The whole story was getting crookeder and crookeder. That's the thing, Brayden continued. He worked and he applied himself and he made himself a better man. He traveled for a while, then he moved back here, bought a grand house in Asheville, and started buying land in the area.
Come on, Serafina said incredulously. You're saying he went from a drunken, poverty-stricken wretch to a gentleman landowner?
I know the whole thing sounds impossible, but you've seen him. Mr. Thorne is a very smart man. He's very rich, and everyone loves him.
She shook her head in frustration. There was no denying any of that. But still, something wasn't right. She looked out across the valley in the mist, just thinking. Nothing about Thorne's story made sense to her. It was like one of those tales that's filled with half-truths and deceptions, little twists in the telling. And she'd learned from hunting rats that where things were a jumble, that's where the rat had been. "So where did your uncle meet him?" she asked.
I think they were both being fitted for shoes at the custom shop downtown.
Which explains why Mr. Vanderbilt's shoes sounded like his.
What?
Nothing. Why does Mr. Thorne always wear gloves? she asked, seeing if she could pick up the scent on a different trail.
I never noticed that he did.
Is there something wrong with his hands? He plays the piano with his gloves on. Doesn't that seem very strange? And he was wearing leather gloves the morning the men found you in the carriage on the forest road, even though it wasn't that cold. And you said he was an expert at machines. Do you think he could break a dynamo so that not even the smartest mechanic in the world could fix it?
What kind of question is that?
Braden asked in confusion. Why do you... And how did a southern plantation owner learn Russian?
I don't know,
Braden muttered, becoming increasingly defensive. And what did he say to Mr. Rostanov? Braden shook his head, refusing to believe any of it.
I don't know. Nobody's perfect.
You said he was extremely smart, could even beat your uncle at chess.
Well, maybe I was wrong. Maybe he just made an honest mistake with Mr. Rostanov.
Then why did poor old Mr. Rostanov get so upset? He was as nettled as a badger in a porcupine fight. But he wasn't just upset. He seemed scared.
Scared? Of what?
Of Thorn.
Why?
Serafina shook her head. She didn't know. Her thoughts were all discombobulated. But it felt like the clues to the mystery were swirling all around her. All she had to do was put them together. Where exactly was the rat hiding? That was the question. You told me that when your aunt met Clara Brahms, she wanted you to be friends with her, Serafina said, trying yet another path.
Yes.
How did your aunt and uncle first meet the Brahms family? Braden shrugged.
I don't know. My uncle knew them somehow.
Your uncle, Serafina said, sensing another connection there.
Why do you say it like that?
Braden asked defensively.
My uncle doesn't have anything to do with any of this, Serafina, so just take it back.
Who told him about Clara being good at piano? How did he hear about her?
I don't know, but my uncle isn't responsible for any of this, I can tell you that much.
Try to remember, Braden, she said. Who first told him about Clara Brahms?
Mr. Bendel and Mr. Thorne. They're always going to symphony concerts and things like that.
And Clara was an exceptionally talented piano player, she said, remembering the maid's words to the footman. She kept trying to think it through. She was getting the same tingling feeling she felt when she was closing in on one of her four-legged enemies.
Yes, I heard her play the first night she came to the house,
Braden said, nodding.
She was extremely good.
And you've heard Thorne play?
Yes, you heard him. He's an excellent player.
And then Braden paused. He frowned and looked at her in surprise.
You don't think...
She just stared at him, seeing if he would come to the same conclusion she had.
Many people know how to play the piano, Serafina,
he said firmly. Not me, she countered.
Well, no, me neither, not like that, but I mean, a lot of people do know how to play the piano really well.
And speak Russian and play the violin, too?
Well, sure. There's Tchaikovsky and...
I don't know who that is, Mr. Know-It-All, but is he also a chess expert?
Well, probably not, but...
And can he turn a team of horses and a full-size carriage around on a narrow mountain road?
You've gone crazy, Braden exclaimed, looking at her in bewilderment. What are you talking about now?
I'm not sure exactly, she admitted. But think about it.
I am thinking about it.
And what do you see?
It's just a big mishmash as far as I can tell.
nothing means anything.
No, everything means something. Think about the black cloak. You've seen it. It seems to allow the wearer to wrap people up and murder them, or at least capture them in some way.
It's horrible, he shuddered.
Maybe it doesn't just murder them.
I don't understand.
Maybe it absorbs them.
That's disgusting. What do you mean?
Maybe that's why Thorne accidentally addressed Mr. Rostanov as father and papa, because Thorne had absorbed his knowledge of the Russian language from Anastasia.
Are you saying that he consumed Anastasia's soul? She grabbed Braden's arm so fast that it startled him and he jumped.
Think about it, she said. The owner of the cloak absorbs his victims, their knowledge, their talents, their skills. Think about what that would mean, what that would be like. If he absorbed enough people, he'd gain many skills and talents. He'd become the most accomplished man in society. He'd be smart, he'd be rich, and everyone would love him. Just like you said.
I refuse to believe Mr. Thorne would do that, Braden said. It's just not possible.
His whole body seemed to be tightening against her. It makes sense, Braden. The whole thing. He's stealing souls. And he's coming for you next.
No, Serafina, Braden said, shaking his head. It can't be. That's crazy. He's a good man.
At that moment, she heard a door from the main house creak open and the sound of someone approaching. Chapter 18. Serafina whirled around, ready to fight.
Braden, darling, what are you doing out here? It's time to come in now, Mrs. Vanderbilt called as she walked toward him.
Serafina breathed a sigh of relief, then darted into the bushes, leaving Braden standing there alone.
Who were you talking to just now? Mrs. Vanderbilt asked.
No one, he said, moving toward his aunt to block her view. Just talking to myself.
It's not safe for you out here, Mrs. Vanderbilt said. You need to come in now and go to bed.
Serafina had never heard Mrs. Vanderbilt sound so tired and upset. The lady of the house clutched a long black coat around her waist to ward against the night's cold. It was clear that the disappearance of the children was taking a heavy toll on her. Hesitating, Braden glanced back into the bushes in Serafina's direction.
Please come inside, Mrs. Vanderbilt said softly but firmly.
All right, he said finally.
Serafina could tell that he didn't want to go, but he didn't want to upset his aunt any more than she already was. Mrs. Vanderbilt put her arm around him, and they began walking back toward the house.
Lock your door,
Serafina half-coughed, half-whispered to Braden, covering her mouth with her hand to garble her words.
Did you hear something?
Mrs. Vanderbilt said, stopping and looking out into the darkness.
I think it was just a fox call out in the woods, Braden said casually.
But Serafina could see him smile and was relieved he wasn't still cross with her for suspecting Mr. Thorne.
Stay safe tonight,
Serafina thought, as Braden and his aunt continued toward the house.
Listen, your uncle and I have been talking, Mrs. Vanderbilt said. We're worried about you.
I'm all right, Braden said.
Your uncle and I need to stay here with the guests, but we've decided that it would be best if you went away from Biltmore for a little while. We tried it before, but we think it's more important than ever now.
I don't want to go away, Braden said, and Serafina knew he was thinking of her.
just until things settle down and the detectives figure out what's going on, Mrs. Vanderbilt said, her voice getting progressively harder to hear as they went back into the house. It'll be safer.
All right, he said. I understand.
We've asked Mr. Thorne to take you with him in his carriage first thing tomorrow morning, she said. Won't that be nice? You like Mr. Thorne, don't you? You'll get to see his house in Asheville. As the door closed behind them, Serafina's heart filled with dread. Braden trusted Mr. Thorne and would have no choice but to agree with his aunt and uncle's wishes. The man in the black cloak would finally get what he wanted. Chapter 19.
I need a plan, Serafina thought as she went down the stairs into the basement. And it has to be tonight.
As she ate a late-night dinner with her pa in the workshop, she wanted to tell him everything and beg for his help to save Braden. But there were no bodies, no weapons, no evidence of any kind to support what her pa would call her imaginings about the Vanderbilt's most trusted guest. Even her best friend didn't believe her. Her pa never would. But more than that, her pa looked so worn out. His hands were blackened and raw with the day's work on the Edison machine. He was under fierce pressure to get the lights back on. And rightly so. The darkness made the whole house the demon's domain. But then she stopped in mid-thought and realized something. The darkness made it her domain as well.
"Are you all right?" her father asked, as he scraped up the last of his potatoes with his spoon. "You haven't eaten anything."
She pulled herself out of her thoughts, looked at her pa, and nodded. "I'm all right."
"Listen, Sarah," her pa said, "I want you to hunker down tonight. Keep to yourself. You hear?"
"I hear, pa," she said obediently. But of course she wouldn't. She couldn't.
When they went to bed and her pa began to snore, she slipped out of the workshop and climbed the stairs that led outside to the estate grounds. Her mind was a whirl with thoughts and images and fears. She knew her pa wanted her to stay close to him, but for the first time in her life, she didn't feel safe in the basement. Staying in the basement tonight was death. It was doom. It would lead to a loneliness she could not bear. Over the last few days, she had felt increasingly constrained there. She didn't want to be inside anymore. She wanted the freedom of open space and true darkness. As she walked outside, it was a beautiful moonlit night, with a light snow gently falling on the grass and trees. She tried to think it all through. She knew what she had to do. She just didn't know how to do it. What stratagem could she devise to defeat the man in the black cloak? If he were a rat, how would she catch him? She walked to the edge of the forest and paused at the point her pa had told her she should never go beyond. Her first foray into the shadows of the forest two nights before had been difficult, terrifying, but she kept going. She pushed through the thick brush and walked into the trees. She delved into the forest using the moonlight and the starlight to illuminate her way. Despite all that had happened, she was still drawn here. This was where she wanted to be. A glint of light caught her eye. She looked up and saw a falling star, then another, then 10 dashing through the blackness, then 100 at once. A shower of falling stars streaked across the sky, filling the crystalline black heavens with blazing light. And then the shower was gone, leaving nothing but the stillness of the glistening stars and the glowing planets in the infinite space above her. She heard tiny footsteps behind her. A small country mouse out foraging and now making his way back home to his family, warm beneath a hollowed log. The forest was alive at night, filled with motion, sound, creatures, and light. She felt comfortable here. Connected. She walked a little farther, studying the lichen-covered rocks, the trees with their outstretched limbs, and the little rills of glistening water that ran beneath the ferns. Was this the forest her mother had come from? Was this where she belonged? She thought about why she could see that Mr. Thorne was the man in the black cloak, but no one else could. Not even Braden. Why could she believe it, but they could not? Because they were normal, mortal human beings, and she was not. She was closer to the man in the black cloak than she wished to admit. Closer to being a demon. She knew she couldn't fight the man in the black cloak directly. He was far too strong. In their first encounters, she had barely escaped him with her life. A shiver ran down her spine just thinking about it. But she couldn't just keep running away and hiding from him either. Somehow, she had to stop him. But he possessed an otherworldly power. If her theory about him was correct, then he had within him all the strength and capability of every person he'd ever absorbed into his cloak. And if she gave him another chance, he would surely absorb her as well. No, she couldn't fight the man in the black cloak head on. Not alone. She looked around her, and a dark idea formed in her mind. She asked herself the question again. If he were a rat, how would she catch him? Suddenly, she knew the answer. She'd bait him. Fear rose up in her like bile from a half-digested meal. She wanted to turn away from the idea, to avoid it. But her mind kept going back to it as the only solution. She thought of her pa's words once more.
Never go into the deep parts of the forest, for there are many dangers there, both dark and bright.
You're right, Pa, she thought. There are, and I'm one of them. Standing in the woods, she came to a conclusion about herself, something that she'd known deep down for a long time, but that she had never wanted to come to grips with. She was not like her pa. She was not like Braden. She was not human. At least, not entirely. The thought of it brought a lump to her throat. She felt a terrible loneliness. She didn't know what it meant. She wasn't even sure she wanted to know what it meant. But she knew it was true. She was not like the people she loved. She'd been born in the forest, a forest as black as the black cloak and as haunted as the graveyard. She was one of them, a creature of the night. She'd overheard Mr. Pratt say that the creatures of the night came straight from hell, that they were evil. She wondered about it again, her mind pushing through thorny brambles of conflict and confusion. Did evil creatures think of themselves as evil? Or did they think they were doing what was right? Was evil something that was in your heart, or was it how people viewed you? She felt like she was good, but was she actually bad and just didn't know it? She lived underground. She slinked through the darkness without being seen or heard. She secretly listened to people's conversations. She pawed through their belongings when they weren't in their rooms. She killed animals. She battled. She lied. She stole. She hid.
She watched children lose their souls. And yet she was still living. Thriving, even. Drawing energy and knowledge and awareness from each and every night that she prowled through the darkness and another child was taken. She stood for a long time, thinking about why she was alive and the others weren't. And she asked herself again, was she good or was she evil? She had been born in and lived in the world of darkness. But which side was she on? Darkness or light? She looked up at the stars. She didn't know what she was or how she got that way, but she knew what she wanted to be. She wanted to be good. She wanted to save Braden and the other children who were still alive. She wanted to protect Biltmore. She thought about the inscription on the base of the Stone Angel's pedestal. Our character isn't defined by the battles we win or lose, but by the battles we dare to fight. Standing in the forest at that moment, that's what she chose to believe. It was true that she was a creature of the night, but she would decide for herself what that meant. She had two choices before her, to slink away and hide, or to dare to fight. At that moment, she saw a plan in her mind and knew what she must do. A part of her didn't want to do it. It would mean she could well die this very night. And her death would come at the moment in her life when she had finally crawled out of the basement and found a friend and begun to understand and connect to the world around her. She wanted to go home and sleep in front of Braden's fireplace and eat chicken and grits with her pa and pretend like none of this was happening. She wanted to curl up in the basement behind the boiler and hide like she'd done all her life. But she couldn't. Thorn was going to keep coming. He was going to take Braden's life. She had to stop him. She might die, but it meant that Braden might live. He'd go on with Mr. and Mrs. Vanderbilt and his horses and with Gideon at his side. And that, she decided, more than anything, was what she wanted. She wanted Braden to live. She'd seen with her own eyes that the man in the black cloak absorbed any child he encountered. But she knew that he wanted Braden Vanderbilt next. She'd seen this when the man in the black cloak attacked them in the forest. He hadn't come for Nolan. He had gone straight for Braden. There was a talent in Braden that Thorne craved. Braden's expertise in horsemanship. But more than that, his almost telepathic connection to animals. She imagined what it would be like to be able to befriend all the animals around her, even to control them. But she sensed there was something more as well. Something that obsessed Mr. Thorne. That drove him even beyond Braden. More and more, he had to take a child every night. Any child. And she'd use that need against him. She would meet him face to face on the most deadly battlefield she could think of. She would defeat him once and for all, or she'd die trying. She turned around and headed back toward the estate. As midnight approached, she went down the stairs toward the workshop. It did not surprise her that her pa was asleep in his cot, snoring gently, exhausted from a long and difficult day. But then she saw something lying on her makeshift bed behind the boiler. As she stepped toward it, she realized it was the dress that Braden had given her. Braden must have come down and laid it there while she was gone. There was a note attached.
S. A and you are determined. I'm leaving early in the morning with tea. I'll see you in a few days. Please stay safe until I return. B.
Serafina stared at the note. She didn't want to believe it. He was really going to do what his aunt and uncle wanted. But then she looked at the dress. She was sure it wasn't Braden's intention, but it was a perfect addition to her plan. Now she would look the part. The time for sneaking and hiding was over. She was going to make sure one man in particular saw her. And tonight was the night. The chief rat catcher had a job to do. Chapter 20. Serafina put on the beautiful dark maroon winter gown that Braden had given her the night before. The intricate black brocade corset felt tight around her chest and back, and she worried that when it came time to fight, it would restrict her. She twisted and turned to test her freedom of movement. The long skirt hung heavily around her legs, but even as unfamiliar as the girl's clothing felt, she couldn't help but be taken by it. It felt almost magical to be putting on a dress for the first time in her life. The material was fine and feminine and soft, like nothing she'd ever worn before. She felt like one of the girls in the books she read, like a real girl, with a real family, with brothers and sisters and a mother and father and friends. She quickly scrubbed her face and brushed her hair and made herself as pretty as she could. It felt silly, but she needed to look the part. She tried to imagine that she was going to an extravagant dance, in a ballroom crowded with glittering ladies and gentlemen, and boys who would ask her to dance. But she wasn't, and she knew it. When she thought about the place she was going and the dark forces she'd meet there, it felt like she was jumping a chasm and she wasn't going to make it to the other side. She tried to block it out of her mind and just kept lacing her dress up her back with shaky fingers, but she was having a terrible go of it. Normal girls must have extremely long and bendy arms to do this every night, she thought. When she was finally done, she looked around at the workshop one last time. She couldn't tamp down the feeling that she wouldn't be coming back. She looked over to where her pa lay sleeping. She had seen how tired and overwhelmed he was. His struggles with the dynamo and searching for her these last few days had taken a toll on him. She wanted to curl up in the crook of his arm like she used to, but she knew she couldn't. "Sleep well, Pa," she thought. Finally, she gathered her courage and turned. She made her way through the basement and then climbed the stairs to the first floor. At the top, she paused. She took a deep breath and then walked down the darkened corridor of the house. She walked slowly, deliberately, not darting and hiding like she normally did, but walking down the center of the wide hallway like a proper young lady. She walked like the girls she had watched from the shadows so many times over the years. She did everything she could to take on the appearance of the helpless young daughter of one of the guests. She was no longer a predator. She was a vulnerable child. The air was very still. Moonlight shone in through the windows, falling onto the marble floor. The grandfather clock in the entrance hall chimed off the 12 bells of midnight. The corridors of the house were mostly empty because it was so late, just a candle here and there to light the way for guests. But she sensed that there were a few people still awake. As she made a slow promenade in her long, wide dress through the broad corridors of the house, it felt deeply strange not to be hunting, not to be the eyes of the predator, but the prey that is seen. Her stomach churned, her muscles flinched and twitched, begging her to dash away. She hated walking straight, and she hated walking slow.
"You're a normal girl," she told herself. "Just keep breathing. Keep pulling air into your lungs. You're a normal girl."
It took every ounce of courage she had to just keep walking a straight line in the open. She'd come up against the man in the black cloak before, but she was determined to make this time different. Tonight, she was going to fight. Fight on her own terms and in her own way, with tooth and claw. She lingered near the winter garden, with its high glass ceiling, just outside the door into the billiard room, where she knew from what she'd learned at Mrs. Vanderbilt's gathering earlier that evening, she had the best chance of setting her trap. Suddenly, the door to the billiard room opened. Mr. Vanderbilt, Mr. Bendel, Mr. Thorne, and several other gentlemen were sitting together in the leather chairs and drinking out of odd-shaped glasses. The smell of cigar smoke wafted into the corridor. Mr. Pratt came out of the room with a large silver tray balanced on his hand and hurried down the hall. Serafina stepped into a shadow behind a column to avoid being seen. And there she waited, lingering on the edge of darkness. She was a china doll, and she was a wraith, in and out of the shadows, a girl in between. Finally, the fireside chat began to break up. Mr. Vanderbilt stood and said good night to each of his guests. Mr. Bendel shook everyone's hand and then retired as well. In the end, only Mr. Thorne remained. Serafina watched him through the open door, her heart pounding slow and heavy. He sat in the candlelit billiard room alone, sipping from his glass and smoking his cigar. "Come on out," she thought. "We have business to attend to." But he seemed to be enjoying a moment of personal triumph. She couldn't read his mind, but she tried to piece together what she knew about him and imagine what he was thinking at that moment. After losing his plantation in the war and falling to the depths of ruin, here he was now, finally back to his rightful place again, a distinguished gentleman of the highest order, a personal friend of one of the richest men in America. All he had to do to get here was steal the souls and talents of 100 lousy children with their small, frail bodies and their pliable spirits. But she wondered, why didn't he absorb adults as well? Were they more difficult? And now that he had achieved his position in society, why did he continue with the attacks and risk discovery? If he'd been doing this for a long time, then why the sudden greed for young souls? What was driving him to absorb a child night after night? It had to be more than just the pursuit of talents. It had to be a need greater than anything that had come before. She watched Mr. Thorne as he sat on the sofa, puffing on his cigar and sipping his cognac. There was something different about him tonight. His face looked gray. The skin under his eyes was wrinkled and flaking. His hair seemed less shiny and perfect than it did the morning in the tapestry gallery when she saw him for the first time, or when he arrived with the rescue party to take Braden back to Biltmore. Mr. Thorne set his empty glass on the end table and stood. Serafina's muscles tensed. The time had come. Like the other gentleman, he wore a formal black jacket and tie, and she could hear the movement of his patent leather shoes on the billiard room's hardwood floor. But when she saw what he was carrying draped over his arm, her breath caught in her throat. It was the black cloak. Satin and shimmering and clean, the cloak was as much in disguise as she was. To anyone else, it was but a fashionable covering. To anyone else, it might have appeared that the handsomely attired gentleman intended to take a quiet stroll on the grounds before he retired for the evening. But she knew the truth. It wasn't just a cloak. It was the black cloak, which meant he was bent on malevolent purpose. Here was her enemy. Here was the fight she'd come for. But she could feel her whole body quaking in her gown. She was scared to death. "At least I'm going to die in a pretty dress," she thought. He walked out of the room and into the corridor where Serafina was hidden in the shadows. She stayed perfectly still. But then he stopped just outside the billiard room door. He could not see her, but he could sense her there. He stood just a few feet away from her. Her heartbeat pounded. She had trouble controlling her breathing. He was right in front of her. All her well-laid plans seemed foolish now. She wanted to cower away, to flee, to slink, to hide, to scream. But she steadied herself. She forced herself quiet, and she did what for her was the most terrifying thing to do in the world. She stepped out into the open. Chapter 21 Serafina stood in her dress in the candlelight of the corridor, where Mr. Thorne could see her. His hair wasn't as dark as she recalled, but far more silvery now, and his eyes were a striking ice blue. He looked much older than she remembered, but he was a startlingly handsome man, a gentleman of distinguished character, and for a moment she was taken aback by it. Her plan had been to pass herself off as a helpless little rich girl, a child guest of the Vanderbilts for him to prey on. Appearing to be easy prey was going to be part of her trick, the rat bait. It was a perfect plan, but she realized now that it wasn't going to work. As they looked at each other face to face, she could tell by his expression that despite the beautiful gown she wore and her unusually well-combed hair, he knew exactly who she was. And it filled her with a wave of terrible dread. She was the girl who had escaped his clutches the night he absorbed Clara Brahms. She was the girl who attacked him in the forest the night he took the stable boy. She was the girl who skulked through the darkness without need of a lantern, the one who could run and hide and jump, and seemed to have impossibly fast reflexes. She was a girl with many talents. And now, here she was, standing right in front of him, a prize for the taking. It was too late to run. When Mr. Thorne smiled, she flinched, but she stood her ground. She was so scared that it hurt to breathe. Her corset felt like Satan's bony hand gripping her around her chest and squeezing her tight. Her limbs were hot with the burning drive to flee. But she didn't. She mustn't. She had to stay. She took in a long, slow, deep breath. Then she turned her back to him and slowly walked away. She walked at what felt like a snail's pace down the corridor, pretending as though she had no idea who he was or that her life was in danger. Her back was to him now, so she could not see him anymore, but she could hear Mr. Thorne's footsteps following her, getting closer and closer behind her, so close that the hairs on the back of her neck stood on end. Unable to control her fear, her arms and hands began to tremble. His footsteps behind her pounded in her temples. There was no doubt in her mind that they were not the footsteps of a mortal man, but of the man in the black cloak. This was the soul stealer.
This was the fiend who had taken Anastasia Rostanova, Clara Brahms, Nolan the pastor's son, and countless others. And he was right behind her.